consciousness into two problems, one easy, the other hard. Problems, easy and hard. The easy problem, which is hard enough, is to understand how the brain processes information. We've made strides in that direction, Tegmark maintains, considering that computers are now advanced enough to defeat the world's chess champion and translate the most difficult foreign languages. Their ability to process information will one day surpass the human brain's abilities, and then it will be nearly impossible to say which is conscious, the machine or a human being. The hard problem is, why do we have subjective experience? No matter how much you know about the hardware of the brain, you haven't really explained how microvolts of electricity and a handful of dancing molecules can deliver a person's awe at seeing the Grand Canyon for the first time, or the rush of joy that music produces. In the inner world of thoughts and feelings, data get left behind. The hard problem acquired its official name thanks to philosopher David Chalmers, but it has been around for centuries as the mind-body problem. Tegmark sees a solution by relying on a scientist's treasured ally, mathematics. To a physicist, he says, a human being is just food whose atoms and molecules have been rearranged in complicated ways. You are what you eat is literally true. How is food rearranged to produce a subjective experience like being in love? Its atoms and molecules, from the perspective of physics, are just an amalgam of quarks and electrons. Tegmark rejects a force beyond the physical universe, that is, God, butting in. The soul is also out. If you measure what all the particles in your brain are doing, he argues, and these particles perfectly obey the laws of physics, then the action of the soul is zero. It adds nothing to the physical picture. If the soul is pushing the particles around, even by a small amount, science would be able to measure the exact effect the soul is having. Voila! The soul becomes just another physical force with properties that can be studied the way we study gravity. Now Tegmark unveils the idea that either solves the hard problem or turns out to be a very clever sleight of hand. As a physicist, he says, the activity of particles in the brain is nothing but a mathematical pattern in space-time. Dealing with a bunch of numbers transforms the hard problem. Instead of asking, why do we have subjective experience, we can look at the known properties of particles and ask a question based on hard facts. Why are some particles arranged so that we feel we are having a subjective experience? This may sound like a movie scene where absent-minded Professor Brainiac is scribbling equations on the blackboard to explain why he's attracted to Marilyn Monroe sitting in the front row. But Tegmark's trick of turning the subjective world into a physics problem has obvious appeal within his field. But it's not hard to be skeptical. Einstein's mind produced wonderful calculations. It's unlikely that wonderful calculations can produce Einstein's mind. But Tegmark argues that they can. The things that exist all around us, he says, possess properties that can't be explained simply by looking at the atoms and molecules they are made of. The H2O molecule doesn't change as water turns into ice or steam. It simply acquires the properties of ice and steam, so-called emergent properties. Like solids, liquids, and gases, Tegmark declares, I think that consciousness, too, is an emergent phenomenon. If I go to sleep and my consciousness goes away, I'm still made of the same particles. The only thing that changed was how the particles are arranged. We are using Tegmark here to stand for a whole class of thinkers who believe that math holds the key to explaining the mind. In their view, consciousness is no different from any other phenomenon in nature. Numbers can be assigned to information, and information is defined by Tegmark and others as what particles know about each other. At this point, a great deal more complexity must be introduced, but you've gotten the key concepts. The focus burns brightest on the integrated information theory proposed by Giulio Tannoni, a neuroscientist at the University of Wisconsin. To bridge the gap between mind and matter, Tannoni and his colleagues devised a consciousness detector that can be used medically, for example, to indicate if someone who is completely paralyzed still has consciousness. Such a development is intriguing for brain research in many ways. But information theorists are hunting for bigger game. They want ones and zeros, the basic units of digital information, to explain consciousness in the cosmos at large. It's true that particles with positive and negative charges can easily be described with a one or a zero. And the same holds true any time a property in nature has an opposite, the way gravity may be coupled with anti-gravity. But do numbers really help us to get from lifeless particles to love, hate, beauty, enjoyment, all the things happening in here? Highly improbable. Knowing that water acquires the emergent properties of ice doesn't get you to ice sculptures. Something else is obviously at work. We are told that information is what particles know about each other. But that's the problem, not the solution. The notion that throwing in more and more information will build a full-fledged human mind is like saying that if you add more cards to the deck, they will suddenly start playing poker. Jacks, queens, and aces all carry information. But that's not the same as knowing what to do with the information, which requires a mind. Letting reality speak for itself. Everyone who has tackled the problem of consciousness feels that they have reality on their side. Yet if you look more closely, no theoretical model can tell us what's real. Radar can tell you when it's raining, but only you can tell that rain is wet. Experience is the only judge. It's remarkable that the nuclear inferno inside a star can be reduced to zeros and ones. But the concepts of zero and one are human. Without us, they wouldn't exist. In fact, there is no information anywhere in nature without a human being who understands the concept of information. With information theory severely undermined, the most common fallback is to say, we can wait for a better theory someday. Meanwhile, there's new brain research emerging every day. It will tell us the story eventually. But this kind of certainty is based on a very shaky assumption that brain equals mind. The entire field of neuroscience is based on this assumption. Undoubtedly, there is activity in the brain when a person is alive and conscious, while death brings the cessation of this activity. But imagine a world where all music comes through radios. If the radios break down, the music dies. Yet this event wouldn't prove that radios are the source of music. They transmit it, which is a big difference from there being Mozart or Bach. The same could be true of the brain. It could simply be the transmitting device that brings us our thoughts and feelings. No matter how powerful brain scans ever become, there's no proof that neural activity creates the mind. The problem with brain equals mind is twofold. First, there's the assumption that the mind is an epiphenomenon. In other words, a secondary effect. If you light a bonfire, the primary phenomenon is combustion. The secondary phenomenon is the heat that the fire gives off. Heat is an epiphenomenon. In brain research, it's assumed that the physical activity inside neurons is the primary phenomenon. The subjective sense of thinking, feeling, and sensing is secondary. Mind becomes an epiphenomenon. Yet it's fairly obvious that being aware of who you are, where you are, and what the world looks like, everything that comes with mind, is just as likely to be primary. Music came before radios. And this fact isn't undermined by studying how radios work, down to their atoms and molecules. The second problem with brain equals mind is that we have no way to see nature accurately. It's hard to grasp just how complete our blindness to reality is. The narrator in Christopher Isherwood's Goodbye to Berlin is a nameless young man who has arrived in Germany during the rise of Hitler. Instead of showing us how appalled he is, Isherwood wants us to make our own judgments, because only then will we believe in the horror of what the narrator sees. The young man begins his tale by saying, "I am a camera with its shutter open, quite passive, recording, not thinking. Recording the man shaving at the window opposite, and the woman in the kimono washing her hair. Someday, all this will have to be developed, carefully printed, fixed." But a camera is exactly what the human brain isn't, or the human mind. We are participants in reality, which makes us totally involved. Quantum physics is famous for bringing the observer into the whole problem of doing science, and equally famous for not solving what the observer's role is. The practice of science didn't grind to a halt waiting for the solution, and therefore a fallback position has been adopted. Leave the observer out. For some physicists, this means leave the observer out for the time being, while for others, the vast majority, it means leave the observer out all the time. It's not as if he really matters. But reality begins with "I am," minus the camera. Every person wakes up in the morning to face the world through first-party consciousness. It's an inescapable fact. With two strikes against it, brain equals mind should be seriously doubted. Ironically, however, the mind needs the brain and can't do without it, so far as we know. Like the imaginary world where radios are the only way to access music, our world has no access to the mind except through the human brain. In his memoirs, psychiatrist David Viscott reported a life-changing incident that happened to him in a hospital when he was in training. He walked into a patient's room just as the patient died, and in that instant, he saw light leave the body, for all the world like the soul or spirit departing. The fact that he had seen such a thing, which isn't uncommon among hospice workers, shook Viscott's beliefs to their core. His worldview couldn't account for such a phenomenon, and he knew that his medical colleagues wouldn't believe him. If they had a soul, that didn't mean they believed in souls. Likewise, even if your brain is just a receiving device for the mind, you can still argue that the brain is the mind. Another proof that your belief system is more powerful than reality. Follow the moving arrow. Is there any way to settle the dispute between mind first and matter first? If our beliefs stand in the way, perhaps reality must speak for itself, so there is no mistaking the results. One avenue stems from many centuries ago, in a paradox first posed in the 5th century BCE by Greek philosopher Zeno. The common term for it is Zeno's arrow paradox. As an arrow flies through the air, Zeno said, we can observe it at any instant in time. When we do, the arrow occupies a specific position. For the instant that it holds any position, the arrow isn't moving. So if time is a series of instants, it follows that the arrow is always motionless. How can an arrow be moving and motionless at the same time? That's the paradox. And it came to life 2 millennia later in the quantum Zeno effect, a term coined by George Sudarshan and Baidyanath Misra of the University of Texas. This time, the object being observed isn't an arrow, but a quantum state, such as a molecule undergoing a transition that would ordinarily decay in a finite amount of time. A quantum state that should decay is frozen by continuous observations. In many, though not all, interpretations of quantum mechanics, the wave-like behavior of a particle collapses into a state we can measure and observe thanks to the observer, although how the observer tinkers with this transition is highly controversial. As we've seen, the actual moment when a molecular state would decay can't be determined, but only estimated using probabilities. But in the quantum Zeno effect, the intervention of observation changes the system from an unstable one to a stable one. Can you stand around watching a molecule constantly to see when the actual event occurs? No. And that's the paradox. If an observer watches continuously or at super-fast intervals, the state being observed will never decay. As with viewing a flying arrow in chopped-up instants of time, observing unstable quantum systems subdivides the chopped-up activity so finely that nothing happens. By analogy, imagine that you are a wedding photographer taking a picture of the bride. When you say, "Smile," the bride says, "I can't smile when the camera is pointing at me." Now you're stuck. As long as you have the camera on her, there will be no smile. If you take the camera away, there will be no picture of her smile. This is the essence of the quantum Zeno effect. Why should this help settle the argument between mind first and matter first? It brings I back into the equation. The quantum Zeno effect shows that reality is like a bride who smiles naturally, only as long as a camera isn't pointing at her. She doesn't like being looked at. But there's the rub. We are always looking at reality. There is no such thing as looking away, which means that how the universe behaves when no one is looking has no meaning. Of course, since human beings have only been around for a fraction of the life of the universe, it remains an open question as to what an observation really is, and, by implication, who is doing the observing. For many physicists, there can be no observer who isn't human. We will return to this point later. The matter-first camp refuses to accept this inescapable fact about constant observation. They are like a wedding photographer who says to the bride, "I don't care if you can't smile when a camera is on you. I'm going to keep the camera on you until I catch a smile." He can wait forever. Apparently,